The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So Donald Trump apparently nodded off during the first week of his criminal trial in Manhattan, maybe more than once. And it got me thinking, what is the most inopportune time that you have fallen asleep in public?
When he did this, it reminded me of being in school, and I have very long hair, so I would nod off but like cover my face with my hair to hide it.
I like the idea of Alahe having like the glasses with the wide open eyes like Homer Simpson.
I remember falling asleep on an airplane and I woke up when they said like, you know, we're beginning our initial descent or whatever. So, and then I realized I had completely been asleep on this guy's shoulder for that whole time. And he was too nice to like nudge me. It must have been at least like an hour.
Welcome to the Campaign Moment. This is Friday, April 19th. I'm Elahe Azadi, co-host of Post Reports. And today I'm joined, as always, by senior politics reporter and author of the Campaign Moment newsletter, Aaron Blake. Aaron, hello.
Hey, Elahe. And rounding out the group this week is Post Congress reporter Liz Goodwin. Thanks for being here, Liz.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Aaron, what are we talking about this week?
Well, we actually have a criminal trial of former President Donald Trump. This is the first criminal trial that he's facing among four indictments. It's also the first criminal trial of a former president, period. And it began with a long jury selection process. So we'll talk a little bit about that and what we've seen in the early days of the so-called hush money election interference case in New York.
Yeah, we're definitely going to get into that. And also, we're going to touch on Biden's strategy on Israel. There is a lot of news there, how that's been playing with fellow Democrats, and just the latest chaos in Congress, which is a perfect reason to have Liz join us. So, Liz, first, I wanted to ask you about some reporting you recently published about Montana Republican Senate candidate Tim Sheehy. Can you start first by laying out what the Senate race in Montana has been like so far this year, and what are the stakes of this race? Why should we be paying attention to this race?
Yeah, so the Senate race in Montana is arguably the most crucial Senate race in 2024. It could end up deciding who controls the Senate. Right now, Democrats narrowly control it. And the head of the NRSC, whose job is basically to win Senate races for Republicans, he is a senator from Montana. So he's taking it very personally. The senator right now who's up for re-election, John Tester, he's the last statewide elected Democrat in the state, which has just been trending redder and redder over the past few years. And he sort of has this staying power that no one can quite explain. He won re-election in 2018, even though Donald Trump was trying very hard to get him booted and went there and did rallies and all that. He has this flat top haircut. He's missing some fingers from a farm accident.
Yeah, the one thing I know about him is he cuts his own hair, right?
Yeah, he's got this kind of charm to him, right? And likability. And really, this race is sort of about, do people like him enough in the state that they're going to ignore the fact that he's a Democrat, essentially, and does tend to vote, you know, with Democrats most of the time, the majority of the time, with some exceptions. So Daines, the Republican senator there who heads the NRSC, he spent a lot of time trying to pick the best possible candidate to take on Tester. And that's how he alighted upon this kind of outsider, relatively unknown person in the state, Tim Sheehy.
Yeah, I know your reporting on Tim Sheehy has, you know, Aaron and I have both been paying attention to it. What's your top line finding in your reporting here?
Yeah, so I was actually kind of reporting a story about Tester. I was sort of calling around, trying to do a story about his base of support, some of the counties that were very Democratic, trending red, actually. So I was on a completely different story when I received a tip that there was a ranger in Glacier National Park, very beautiful park in the state, who recalled responding to an incident in 2015, almost 10 years ago, where someone who he was pretty sure was Tim Sheehy had accidentally shot himself in the arm. So it was just a matter of trying to follow up that tip and see if it really happened. And, you know, eventually we did get the documents that showed that this incident happened. He told a park ranger that he had shot himself in the right forearm accidentally when his gun fell out of his vehicle that he was loading up after his hike, and it discharged into his arm.
And I guess in reading your story, the thing that really stood out to me is that Tim Sheehy's service record as a Navy SEAL is pretty core to his identity as a candidate in this race, right?
Yeah. So, you know, when we came to Sheehy and his campaign and said, you know, this shows that this happened in 2015, part of the reason why we really needed a response from them is that he says he has a bullet in his arm, his right forearm, the same place where the document says he accidentally shot himself, that bullet is from his time serving in Afghanistan as a Navy SEAL. He is a combat wounded veteran. He has a Purple Heart for getting knocked unconscious by an IED. He saw a lot of really tough combat based on other people in his platoon, what they've said about that year in 2012 when they were deployed. But the fact that this document existed did raise questions about the bullet wound in his arm and its provenance. And Sheehy said very vociferously that this incident with shooting himself never happened, that this was something he made up on the spot because he fell down on this hike and he was worried that the old bullet from Afghanistan had gotten dislodged and was going to injure him in some way. So he went to the hospital, and then once he was there, there was a misunderstanding and they were going to report the gunshot wound as new. And so then he made up a story that, yes, he had just shot himself in the park because he was worried that the hospital or the ranger or some combination of the two would start an investigation into this old bullet wound, which he was worried the Navy would like open up some NCIS thing, even though it was from years earlier, because he thought the bullet was possibly from a friendly fire incident.
I think this is an important story. And this stuff gets lost in the fold these days because Donald Trump is like this vacuum that sucks all the air out of the political news cycle. But these Senate races and this story about Tim Sheehy is so important because Republicans in recent years have struggled to win the Senate for a very simple reason. And a lot of it is that their candidates haven't panned out. They've had problems. They've gone too far to the extreme. You know, we saw this a decade ago. We saw this in 2022 with candidates like Herschel Walker and Blake Masters and Mehmet Oz, who really just didn't do as well as a Republican should do in their states. And so Tim Sheehy is somebody who comes along and seems to have kind of the ideal bio for a candidate. This could be the crucial race in the battle for the Senate. And to the extent that Tim Sheehy has these problems that are going to complicate this for Republicans, it's a very significant story when it comes to the Senate majority math.
Liz, I have to tell you, I was aware of your story before it published, not because I work at The Washington Post, but because I saw Tim Sheehy posting about it on social media before it published. Critical comments in response to you and your colleagues reaching out for more clarification about his background. How has his campaign now responded that your reporting, now that your reporting has published?
He and his campaign have been very critical. There's been an attempt to just say that we are trying to smear a war hero. That's the main kind of response. There hasn't been a lot of like point by point, you know, this thing is wrong or this thing is wrong. Like, but there's definitely been an attempt to say that we're smearing a war hero or somehow questioning his Purple Heart, which we are not. We did want to see a copy of the citation of the Purple Heart, which just describes how you got it, because it would have added to the story to have those details. But they were not willing to provide it.
Yeah, and at the very least, I think it's worth emphasizing here that regardless of what happened in this situation or where the gunshot wound came from, Tim Sheehy has acknowledged lying to a federal officer about this incident. Like, this is a story regardless of what happened. And it's been remarkable to see people, including some in conservative media, going after this for what is very traditional reporting on a candidate who is running for office.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of just traditional beat reporting. You look into a candidate's background, you vet them so the public can make up their mind. That's what it struck me
exactly.
as. So,
yep.
Liz, thanks for sharing your reporting process. It's super fascinating. Now, I did want to turn to the other big news this week, and that, as was mentioned, is former President Donald Trump's first criminal trial, and it began in Manhattan on Monday this week. So, Aaron, it was jury selection, right? That was the big news of this week.
Yeah, it's kind of a slow build. This is a situation in which the jury selection process is a lengthy one. So as of Thursday, we had a full slate of 12 jurors. On Friday, they're adding the alternates. So they're hoping to start the trial next week. But what we've seen is that there's been a number of clashes over not just these potential jurors and their backgrounds and their social media posts, but also Trump's courtroom antics, potential violations of his gag order in the case by saying things about jurors and witnesses and the judge's daughter and surfacing news stories and commentary from his allies. So it's really kind of building, and it's a very charged political scene, even aside from the legal questions involved.
Yeah, I think it probably provides some sort of window as to how the rest of the trial goes. And the thing that really struck me this week watching the jury selection process was it's felt pretty unconventional. I don't know, Liz and Aaron, if you guys have ever been in a jury pool. I was in a jury pool, I think, last year for a kind of high profile case. I was not chosen, so I can talk about it. But I was not asked this up front. If any prospective juror says they can't be fair and impartial, raise your hand. And that's what happened in this case. About half the jurors raised their hands and they were immediately dismissed. So what are some of the other things that have surprised both of you about how this jury selection process has unfolded?
Yeah, that one is a notable one. The idea that a prospective juror, can raise their hand and say that they can't be fair and impartial and just be dismissed right away. That's not how this is usually handled, according to the experts that I've spoken to. But this is also an unconventional case. This is a situation in which 3/4 of Americans have strong opinions about former President Trump. Half of Americans have basically told, you know, in polls of this, they've decided that he's either guilty or blameless. So they're kind of prejudged the case. So the judge made a decision that he's basically going to let people opt out if they decided they can't be fair. And so around half of the jury pool has taken that option. But, you know, I think it's also something that speeds up the process a little bit because it means you don't have to scrutinize those people who basically say they can't be fair and impartial. And that's allowed the process to turn to people who are perhaps a little bit less problematic on that front.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's such an exercise to try to find people who don't have an opinion about Trump. You know, he's right. One of the most ubiquitous political figures in American history, and he's just such a lightning rod in either direction. And just watching that process play out is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and like how many people just on any trial would want to raise their hands up front and try and get out of it? I mean, just doing this trial is going to go on for several weeks. So that was a question just in my head. But I also wondered about what it must feel like for these jurors, because this is such a high profile case. And I know the court has taken a lot of precautions to try to keep the jurors safe. Namely, you know, we are keeping the names of the jurors anonymous, but already we've seen that this hasn't gone according to plan, exactly according to plan. So, Aaron, I know that you posted about this on X, that Fox News host Jesse Waters went through a juror's bio and on air and suggested she'd be bad for Trump. And we should acknowledge that other media outlets had also described this particular juror's occupation, like CNN, The Post ran a little bit of that. Others, like NBC, specified her employer. No one's naming her, but this juror number two asked to be excused. So what is the fallout from that and what lessons should we take?
Yeah, I think this situation highlights just how charged this whole thing is. It is important to note, as you note, that Jesse Waters was not the only one going through these bio details, but he was also saying basically that these bio details that he went through made this a suspect juror. This is somebody who had been selected at this point. And he went through her bio and said, quote, "I'm not so sure about juror number two." The next night on his show, he said, "This nurse scares me if I'm Trump." And in between that, he went on another show and was talking about the idea that, quote, undercover liberal activists were trying to get on this jury. Donald Trump actually promoted that comment, even though he's barred from making public comments about jurors, which is a potential gag order issue, which we might talk about. But you begin to see how these jurors might feel intimidated. And we actually had a scene on Tuesday where the judge Donald Trump was muttering something in the direction of a prospective juror, and the judge basically said, I will not have jurors be intimidated in my courtroom, seemingly interpreting what Trump was doing as possibly intimidation. So it does reinforce how difficult this process is going to be and how difficult Trump makes it in certain ways by surfacing these claims that he's being targeted and that the jury's going to be stacked against him and things like that.
Yeah, I think also it's just such a time-honored Trump tradition to work the refs. Like in a trial, in any kind of legal proceeding, in an election, if there's a bad story, you know, in the media about him, it's always that it's fixed, it's rigged. And so, yeah, if you're in the jury box, it's just not a doubt, unless the verdict ends up being not guilty, that those people are going to get targeted and painted as unfair or crooked in some way. And because they're just regular civilians, that can be kind of scary.
Yeah, it also makes me think about how, you know, Donald Trump has called this a persecution, said this is, you know, an unfair trial. He shouldn't, you know, he's very much made it clear he does not think he should be on trial right now. And in some ways, it's like on both sides, it's either, you know, him running for president makes this so complicated for the judicial system. But also, I know, Aaron, you've pointed out in some of the work that you've done this week, which I thought was such a smart point, that he also, because of the position he's in, he's getting away with more than any other criminal defendant would get away with in this situation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's evident that the idea that the judge is going to put Trump in jail for violating a gag order or juror intimidation, that's a very difficult thing to do because of who Trump is, not just because of the, you know, Secret Service particulars that are involved in that, which is also a valid issue. But this is a former president who has already violated a number of gag orders in another case. He's made a number of comments, posts on social media that at the very least flout the gag order in this case, which prevents him from talking about jurors, witnesses, the judge's daughter. He's promoted commentary from his allies on all of those subjects. And so there's going to be a hearing next week on that gag order. But I think it's worth emphasizing that he's at the very least kind of putting this situation in a very uneasy state by doing these things. And it all seems very intentional. You know, in one way, this is him lashing out at a process that he seems to regard as being unfair. But in another way, it's just testing the system and kind of maybe trying to turn it into a circus and hoping that this causes people to kind of throw up their hands and decide that this just isn't worth paying attention to or that it's impenetrable for them. And so I think that the gag order thing and the conduct with the jurors, it's all going to be very important to look at as we move forward, not just for this case and not just for the politics, but also for kind of the standing of a judicial system in this country that has been embattled throughout his 8 years as a politician.
So let's take a pause there. And after the break, we're going to get into the latest developments coming out of Israel and how that might affect President Biden's posture toward that country. We'll be right back.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So the big news last night was that Israel carried out a strike within Iran, and this was in retaliation for Iran's attack on Israel last weekend. And it appears right now, you know, we're talking Friday morning, that the damage from the Israeli strike on Iran is limited, and more details could come out as the day unfolds. But the fact now that we can say that Israel carried out this counterattack inside of Iran, this in some ways is just the latest example of Israel ignoring the wishes of the Biden administration. Because just earlier this week, Biden had urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to cool things down in the region. You know, he had told Netanyahu to, quote, take the win. basically saying Israel had successfully thwarted this Iranian attack. It had huge help from its allies to just sort of step away from the escalation in the region. And it doesn't seem like they did that. So, Aaron, how do you think this latest development will impact Biden's posture towards Israel, as well as its war with Hamas?
Yeah, it's a growing dilemma. And I think it's worth noting that Secretary of State Antony Blinken basically said that the United States didn't participate in this. This is a big political issue. It's a big foreign policy issue, obviously, but it's a big political issue because President Biden's party is divided in half on this issue. We see an increasing number of Democrats basically siding with the Palestinian cause, if not necessarily Hamas itself. We had the Israeli strike that killed 7 humanitarian aid workers from the World Central Kitchen, Jose Andres's organization, a few weeks ago. And we started to see the Biden administration take a more cautious kind of line towards what Israel is doing. I think what we see from Democrats is more emphasis on the idea that the Biden administration needs to be forceful in preventing this situation from getting more out of hand than it is. So we've seen progressives in Congress, you know, we're putting together a draft letter calling on Biden to stop the weapons transfers. We saw a top Biden ally from his home state, Chris Coons, talk about putting conditions on aid. Former Obama administration officials are openly criticizing Biden for talking tough about Israel, but not necessarily backing it up with actions. So there are not good options here for Biden, whose inclination at least is to side with Israel, given that Israel isn't doing what he wants it to. And at some point, you know, there are difficult decisions that are going to have to be made. And the fact that these tensions between Iran and Israel with strikes on each other, which doesn't happen, that just creates
like
a whole new dynamic here. Like ever, yes. Like this is, you know, there wasn't a ton of damage from these strikes. Israel turned them aside. Its strike into Iran was not a huge one. But these are unprecedented events, and that creates a kind of a powder keg in the Middle East, even more so than we had before.
Liz, I know that you've covered how Democrats in the Senate for a while have been growing frustrated by Biden's strategy on Israel. So can you tell us a little bit about what those attitudes are and why it's, you know, I thought your reporting on that was so revealing that the Senate was a place where a lot of that dissent was sort of bubbling up.
Yeah, I think there's a growing number of Democratic senators who have felt like Bibi Netanyahu is just so boldly flouting everything that President Biden is saying that it's kind of reached an unacceptable, untenable kind of point. And I think the biggest illustration of that is, you know, you had more lefty people saying that in the Senate, but just a few weeks ago, Leader Schumer, who's one of the biggest supporters of Israel among the Democrats in Congress, he gave a speech a few weeks ago calling for new elections as soon as the war winds down. He was very critical of Netanyahu. So it just shows at what a breaking point Democrats are. But I would say it hasn't really meant anything policy-wise that like I've been able to discern. And there is movement now to finally send this money to Ukraine and to Israel that has billions of dollars in offensive aid. So you have some sort of surprising, more moderate Democratic voices raising questions about offensive aid if Israel can't guarantee safety to humanitarian workers at the very least, or provide clarity on what they plan to do in Rafah, which obviously Biden's been saying, don't go in there. We can't have way more civilian deaths like this, but they have continued to say their plan is to go in for now. So it's just hard to know what it means in terms of actual aid or conditioning, even the fact that it's being discussed is such a dramatic shift from where Congress has always been on Israel. But it's just unclear to me if anything's actually going to change or what the breaking point would be or if it exists.
I think it's important to note, too, that like the Democratic Party has been very united in the Trump era. Like, Trump is the big uniter of Democrats. They've all got this common enemy that they're working against. And so we haven't seen, like, the Bernie wing of the party, like, really kind of divide the party. And this is testing that. Like, this is something that obviously arises significant passions. We've seen them kind of, the ones who are, you know, skeptical of what Israel is doing kind of slowly inch towards raising concerns. But we haven't seen it kind of turn into a full-scale revolt. And that doesn't mean it can't, but the situation is very tenuous right now in the Democratic Party.
Yeah. And am I right in reading the situation among these Senate Democrats that they have to answer to their voters who feel very impassioned about it? So in some ways, Liz, does this sort of just demonstrate the divisions among voters and the American public more than just, you know, these politicians?
I do think they're responding to their voters just as all politicians do, right? But there's still a huge gap between where Democratic lawmakers are and polls that show Democrats pretty much split down the middle at this point. It's not a 50-50 issue among Democratic lawmakers. You're going to see people defect in the House, I think, House progressives on this new package that has Israel-Ukraine aid on Israel, I imagine. But it's not at all like half of Democrats. It's just, it's still not there yet. I think also the fact that Iran did a strike on Israel over the weekend changed the conversation a little bit away from the concerns about the humanitarian aid and just the tactics in Gaza.
Right. So speaking of foreign aid to Israel, right now we're also in a moment where the House will be voting on a series of foreign aid bills. And one of them is for Israel as well as Ukraine separately. And this was a plan that was designed by the Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, which is somewhat confusing to me because didn't he for a while seem to oppose at least the Ukraine funding? Liz, what changed here?
Yeah, so Johnson's journey on this has been really fascinating to me. I don't follow him incredibly closely because I'm more focused on the Senate. And in the Senate, you know, Schumer and McConnell have really been united on Ukraine aid, the importance of it. McConnell's coming from that like Reagan Republican perspective of don't let Russia march through Europe, a little bit more like Cold War mentality as well. And I think the House Republicans just could not be farther from that. They're just in a different universe on Ukraine aid and what it means. And Johnson has really been listening to them. But we have heard kind of murmurs this whole time that he was disturbed by the intel on Putin. He's disturbed by the situation, but he just really wasn't doing anything about it because it's just so politically untenable and his job hangs in the balance. But you know, what he said the other day where he said, you know, I'm a Reagan Republican and I'm worried about this and I don't want to be Neville Chamberlain, essentially. He didn't say that, but that was kind of the tenor of
the vibe.
Yeah, like that had been things that I had heard about him, like how he felt internally. And I think he just kind of let it rip once, you know, he just knew he might lose his job over this. He's just kind of sharing how he really feels in a louder, bolder way.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me is this almost feels like a moment of deja vu because now we have Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, who has threatened to remove Mike Johnson from the speakership. And it's, you know, Republicans did this to the last speaker, Kevin McCarthy, back in October of last year. That's how Mike Johnson even ended up in this job. And Aaron, what has Greene said about her justification for potentially trying to remove him? How does, and this connects to the Ukraine issue, right?
Yeah, it's a lot about the Ukraine issue. Marjorie Taylor Greene has been among the most dug-in members of Congress against that aid. And so this is the tool that people like her have in a very closely divided House. They can force a vote if one member raises this. Only a number of Republicans need to vote to oust the speaker if all the Democrats are voting on the other side. I think what's really interesting here is there seems to be kind of a Republican establishment strikes back moment on this. They view the ouster of McCarthy as kind of marginalizing the House Freedom Caucus, the hard right House Freedom Caucus that kind of leads these motion to vacate efforts and opposes House leadership. They've seen how this has basically forced the speaker to get votes from Democrats on all these major pieces of legislation. And so if this foreign aid bill is getting to a vote, it's because Democrats are voting for the rule, which is a very important step in this process, because not enough Republicans are voting for that rule, but Democrats are providing the votes. And so basically, we saw comments actually from Matt Gaetz, the congressman from Florida, who was a leader of the effort to oust McCarthy, who basically acknowledged that the House Freedom Caucus has been marginalized, that the House is now working with something of a coalition set up here where it's the establishment Republicans and the Democrats who are getting things done. And we're also seeing members of that establishment kind of hit back and say they might want to change the rules about the motion to vacate. They might want to remove these far-right members from the Rules Committee that have been gumming up the works. So it's a really interesting situation that's kind of building right now around this foreign aid vote that has lots of implications for how the House is going to function and how kind of continually emboldened the far-right is going to be to try and do these things.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because this mechanism by which Green may try to get Johnson out and which, you know, led to McCarthy's downfall was something that McCarthy gave these far-right people, hardline Republicans, in order to get the job in the first place. So is there now seriously appetite, though, among some Republicans to remove Johnson and go into this? There was so much chaos when this happened before. So I'm wondering whether they would even want to embark on this again.
Yeah, I think there's people really are feeling torn. There's definitely a contingent of harder right Republicans who are saying, like, we shouldn't go down this road until we have a person. That's been like the big lesson.
Like, have a plan before you start doing things.
Yes. And, you know, there has just been it really doesn't feel like the last one with McCarthy where the eight kind of emerged and they were a block and they made their opinions known and they were very defiant about it. It's been a little bit more of like a slow boil, starting just with Green, who started out sounding a little bit not sure what she was going to do or not committed. But this week when Massey, another member of Congress, joined on, because their margin is so slim, it just became a thing.
And also the Freedom Caucus has to worry about Democrats potentially saving Johnson at this point. I mean, Democrats have kind of kept their powder dry on that question of whether they would vote against the motion to vacate. They've kind of left it out there and tried to use it as leverage. But, you know, Mike Johnson is giving the Biden administration what it wants with this foreign aid bill. President Biden came out in support of this plan to have these separate votes in the House. And so it creates a situation where, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massey can force this motion to vacate. But what happens if Democrats actually save Mike Johnson? And then you basically have even more of what's basically a coalition government. And that doesn't look good for the House Freedom Caucus at all.
So looking ahead to next week, I am wondering what you will both be paying attention to. So I will start with you, Aaron. What will you be paying attention to in the following week?
Yeah, you know, obviously the trial, we're actually going to get into the nitty-gritty beyond the jury selection, it appears. But also, Israel striking Iran is no small thing. This is going to have repercussions. It's a situation that's going to linger for Biden in ways that are very unpredictable. This could be a moment where those foreign aid votes in the House could be triumphant for Biden and for the process. But this is kind of risking overshadowing all that. So I think this is going to be very important to watch.
For me, next week would be all, you know, if the House ends up passing the foreign aid, what does the Senate do with it? And then if it actually really does pass both the House and the Senate, it just feels like such a big moment for Biden, honestly, because he's been trying to get them to pass Ukraine aid for so long now, and it really did look hopeless. I didn't think it was going to happen, for example. So if that actually happens, I think that's like it's a pretty big deal. And then I think how the left processes all the aid for Israel, given how their voters feel about it and how the war's been going and now will also be something to watch if that does pass.
We will have to end it there. That is it for today's episode. Thank you, Liz, so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks, Aaron, as always.
Thank you. And make sure you sign up for the Campaign Moment newsletter. It's in the show notes at postreports.com.
Liz Goodwin is a Congress reporter for The Post, and Aaron Blake is a senior political reporter and author of the Campaign Moment newsletter. That's it for this week on The Campaign Moment. If you're tuning in via Post Reports, we'll keep bringing you these conversations most Fridays. But you'll be able to hear more from Aaron and our other colleagues by also following The Campaign Moment show feed itself. That's where we'll be dropping extra episodes as campaign news picks up, so you will want to follow that feed as well. And now for some credits. Today's episode was produced and mixed by Ted Muldoon. It was edited by Lucy Perkins. Our team also includes Maggie Penman, Rena Flores, Monica Campbell, Alana Gordon, Ariel Plotnick, Bishop San, Renny Svernovsky, Sabi Robinson, Emma Talkoff, Sean Carter, Peter Bresnan, Allison Michaels, Renita Jablonski, and Martine Powers. I'm Elahe Izadi. We'll be back on Monday with more stories from The Washington Post.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.